Welcome to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. My name is Fraggle Byrne. Every week I speak to leading figures from the world of sustainability and explore the sustainability agenda in marketing and strategy, technology, innovation, investment and finance. We look at the latest thinking, what's working, and the future and evolution of the sustainability agenda. So thank you very much, Daniel, for taking the time to join me today on the Sustainability Agenda podcast.
Thank you, Fergal, for having me on. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Excellent. So I am very interested to talk to you about some of the research you've done recently, your book on climate change, capitalism and corporations, and get some of your thoughts on the role of corporates in dealing with major environmental issues, particularly climate change, but also more generally. Can you tell us a little bit about your background and what you do?
All right. So my background is firmly in social sciences. So I'm not a climate change scientist. I study corporations. I have been working in business schools for the last 10 years or so around how corporations respond to climate change. So that is my particular focus, is looking at corporations, how they engage both internally in looking at their own practices in trying to be more environmental friendly or more environmentally efficient, but also how they work in the public sphere in trying to influence societies to react or respond to climate change in particular ways.
Right, right. Now, climate change is clearly a dominant environmental challenge and probably reflects similar kind of trends with respect to other environmental questions as well. But it is overarching. It's the one which is on, I guess, everyone's radar at the moment. Now, you did some research recently on the behaviour of a number of large Australian corporates, I think. Their response to climate change changed over time and the various different phases, and unfortunately in the end seemed to fade away. Can you talk a little bit about what you were looking at during this research and what you found out?
Yeah, so with my co-author Chris Wright at the University of Sydney, we try to understand how corporations engage with climate change, but doing this by talking to corporations. So while the book is mainly focused around four or five industries, we talk to around 100 sustainability managers or managers in different global corporations and large Australian corporations. These are corporations who have well-established sustainability agendas or CSR departments, have clear strategies in place, policies in place, in trying to do their best in terms of responding to climate change. And we found that when we met these sustainability managers, they were often what we perhaps can refer to as greenies, well read up on different aspects surrounding sustainability as well as climate change, and willing, and really willing to act on this and thinking it is important. So that we can see there's a lot of motivation and drive. And many corporations use this also to motivate the workforce. So they have green armies or CSR teams or sustainability teams. They have green days and stuff like that to get the workforce engaged in what they seem as an important issue. So, and often there's perhaps a CEO who leads this initiative, say a new CEO comes in, maybe a firm believing climate change and think this is important, and starting a range of new initiatives. And then they have policies to back this up. So within each of statements, there also often comes, you know, they're trying to walk the talk in establishing new sustainability practices, often around recycling, energy efficiency and stuff like that. But there is always a moment in time when the sustainability agenda clashes with the main motive of any business, that is to make money. So when there's always that time when the climate change initiative or sustainability initiative is more costly than it is profitable. And as soon as it doesn't display that business case, which it often doesn't. I mean, some of these acts we need to do to stop climate change, it's going to be expensive. So when that business case is not upheld, they seem to wean off and find other excuses and other discourses of rationale to justify why they're not doing climate change. And this can happen over ranges. Say they have a low profit year or not growing that particular year, then they go back to basics and say, look, climate change and all that is all real good when it's good time. In bad times, we need to go back to basics. And back to basics is never really climate change sustainability for most corporations. It's rather to make money and grow. So this is just one example of then when they start weaning off. And then, but that doesn't mean it can't happen again. A new CEO come around and say, look, climate change is really important. We need to do something about it. And off they go again. But eventually, again, it's going to lead to there's going to be a cost associated with being trying to be greener. And since they can't justify the initiatives anymore, they try to use other languages to scale back on this. They often translate climate change into stuff that they're more comfortable with. So, for example, we have seen in many, many corporations how sustainability as a green issue over time get translated to the sustainability of the corporation. That is, the environmental or green concern get translated into long-term profit concern.
Yes, yes. Now, to what extent is this a uniquely Australian phenomenon?
Oh, sorry, we don't think this is uniquely Australian at all. So these are big Australian corporations, and one of the big corporations is not an Australian original corporation. They have a big operation in Australia, but they're US-based mainly. And a lot of the corporations we spoke to while we are based in Australia has global headquarters outside Australia.
Right. Now, this is a pretty depressing finding. How emblematic were the companies that you studied? How widespread do you think this is? And what are some of the factors that come into play here? Because clearly the corporation, I mean, a complex topic. There are a lot of layers to this. At the heart of it, you're talking about their desire and their need to make profits and investors' requirement that they do so. There are other stakeholders as well. Can you talk a little bit about how you saw that their influence of the different stakeholders and what happened? What was driving this?
Yeah, I mean, as consumers, and you know, we also have green groups as like Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth and so on. And consumers put pressure on these corporations often to start engaging with these issues. And that also can mean at times it turns out to be a marketing ploy than a real sustainability or climate change agenda that really changes the drive of the corporation. We also know that these things goes in cycle in terms of how much media these corporations get. So you remember the Volkswagen diesel scandal, which really, if there was a social contract between the consumer and Volkswagen, Volkswagen should not make so much money the following year. That, you know, there is no social contract. One can rather talk about an idea of a social contract, a simulacra in that sense. But really, as a consumers, largely, we don't really consider the green concerns more than any other. So that social contract is perhaps a bit overstated in that corporations can obviously behave quite badly without anyone reacting in long term. Of course, there would be a short-term share drop price, but over the long term, even recent scandals doesn't seem to affect the business so much, Volkswagen being one, BP being another. And we have also other fossil fuel over history, you know, have had problems surrounding sustainability, which doesn't seem to impact much of their long-term growth or profit.
Yes, right. Well, you touched on a few interesting points there, the social contract. But you've also, I guess, highlighted this question at the heart of it, which is this question about profitability. And are you suggesting that sustainability is not, cannot be, or and largely is not a profitable activity for corporations? I know there's been research, and I'm sure you're familiar with, in LBS and in Harvard and George Serafim and others, that seems to suggest that sustainability is profitable for the corporation and profitable for shareholders as well. And we can get onto the role of investors and some of the changes that are taking place there. But are you saying that you just think that that's not true, that it might be in a couple of isolated cases, but fundamentally, it's not the case?
I guess to answer the question, we need to define sustainability. Because if you suggest that it's more profitable for corporations to be more energy efficient, it's obvious. If you suggest that it's more profitable for corporations to
communicate green concerns to the consumer, of course, the consumer wants to hear that. However, I don't think continuous growth and continuous increased profit margins is compatible with a green type of sustainability, where we take into account the planetary boundaries we have to live within.
Right, because I guess there's a big debate here, isn't it, at the heart of this sustainability of environmentalism, and is this question of green growth, and whether green growth is a contradiction in terms, whether it's the source of the problem, that growth is the source of the problem, and there are those who would argue that the scale of the challenges that we face and the time frame in which we need to make changes suggests that we require major changes. We require innovation, we require new technologies, and they can have a role to play, and corporations are very good at doing that. And you can just see that you see changes in the motor industry, you can see changes in solar power, you can see in many different niches, many different industries. Indeed, there are huge growth opportunities associated with sustainability, was associated with climate change. You don't think so?
No, I'm not disputing what you're saying. Of course, there is fantastic growth opportunities in new technology and new innovation. There is clearly a market to make sure that we can respond better, perhaps even to than what you're doing. But for me, there's absolutely not it's absolutely a contradiction between growth and innovation, technology, and climate change. So what we're doing with this language is that we are making sure that we really don't have to change anything. Because if you believe in new technology, innovation, growth opportunity, we don't really need to change anything. And if you look at the emissions, they are still going up. And we've been talking about this growth and new technology innovation for a couple of decades now. And the emissions are still growing up. So for me, we need to start thinking completely different. We need an absolute radical change in how we organize us, how we identify our society, who we are as human beings, who we are in relation to in relation to other people. There's no way we can go on. Because even if we come up with really good new technology and wind and renewables and solar, the problem is that these industries doesn't catch up. Because the growth imperative is so important that even if we come up with new technologies in renewables, they're still not addressing the problem of fossil fuel.
Right. Well, I mean, clearly, the question of fossil fuel is clearly another specific one, which we can maybe touch on a little bit. Clearly, there's a difference between saying corporations are the solution and saying corporations can be part of the solution, and some corporations can contribute to helping. And in a similar way, it's surely we can hold the idea that corporations can have a role to play without saying that there doesn't also need to be regulation.
Yes, I mean, of course, I think I'm definitely for some for plurality here. And I guess part of the problem is that we only basically look to normal corporate solutions. We look to market mechanism. We look to new technology. We look for innovation. And this, for me, is absolutely not enough. There's no chance that the corporations, with their short-term thinking, can address a complexity like climate change. For me, that's impossible for them. Obviously, they have an important role to play in making sure that the transition is working, and I prefer corporations to be less unsustainable than anything else. But at the moment, we seem to put almost all our faith in corporation, and I think that is a catastrophe in terms of being able to act on climate change.
At the heart of this, how do you envisage what kind of organizational form would be appropriate to deal with the kind of questions that we're looking at?
Oh, that's a fantastic question. And I guess that requires some imagination and looking forward and looking for what kind of organization do we need in society to deal with kind of problems like this. No doubt we need stronger governments. And with stronger government, I'm not suggesting sort of a strong-handed government in the classical terms. I'm meaning a stronger government where we can see perhaps a Pollyannian double movement, where when corporations are eating into quite a lot of civil society, we used to see a swing back through government regulation. So an example would be in the 70s in the US, after Rachel Carson's book, The Silent Spring, we saw how EPA was funded, how a range of different legislation came into play in the US. Similar movement happened all over the Europe in around the 70s and 80s. However, since then, we can also see how a lot of these legislations has been dissolved or disappeared. And a lot of us recognize, I think, and this is, I don't think, a big statement, is that corporations now has been taking over quite a lot of civil society functions, and there seems to be a lack of legislation around corporations, perhaps illustrated through the financial crisis. But what we're not seeing at this time around, so we have the same problem, a lot of people recognize, wait a second, this is not right, well, they seem to have a little bit too much power. What we're not seeing this time around, but that we saw in the 70s and 80s, we're not seeing the government stepping back in and increasing legislation around a lot of these things. Rather, we're trusting the corporations to do it themselves. So we say, look, we want you to voluntarily do this, we want you to report on this, and we see also that corporations continue to fight this. It doesn't matter what area of sustainability, social environment, Coca-Cola will fight higher sugar tax. The tobacco companies did fight any legislation around cigarettes. The fossil fuel is desperately fighting anything minimizing their profit around fossil fuel. So having the fossil fuel to fund part of the Paris meeting and having them at the table in discussing energy solutions, for me, is a bit problematic in that this will stop the double movement we need. We need 80% of fossil fuels to stay in the ground. And we don't need Shell and BP to sit on the table discussing energy solutions.
Right, that's an interesting question, isn't it? The degree to which they can be part of the solution. They should be at the table, shouldn't they? The question becomes, how much power should they have at the table?
Well, yes and no. I'm not sure they should be at the table. In the sense of, we have experts, and you have spoken to many of them outside the business sector, who know quite a lot about this. We have universities full of fantastic researchers with pretty good solutions. We have politicians, we have policy makers, we have bureaucrats, we have good handle of this. It didn't used to be that we invited the corporation that we discussed into this discussion. Of course they should have a say, but maybe not at the table though. Because they come with a particular narrow interest that the rest of the stakeholders may not.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. There is this question, I suppose, how fit for purpose are corporations to deal with the kind of questions that we're talking about here? I mean, there's been quite strong momentum in the B Corps in America and things like that. But at the heart of it, if you are saying that measuring profits, and again, this is something which is a bit of a contested territory as well, I think, insofar as researchers in America now have shown that this is the idea of fiduciary responsibility to increase profits is not actually legally valid. And there are lots of questions around that. And yet it's still held to be so. And even if not with respect to the corporation, it is with respect to the investors, that the investors have a fiduciary responsibility, and that becomes potentially a break on the kind of things that corporations can do. So, right. And at the heart of this clearly is this question of growth, yes. growth in output, growth in profits. Investors' desire for growth and profits. Now, we're seeing some kinds of changes here going on. Now, how deep do you think these changes are? I mean, every day we seem to be seeing, we've just seen Legal & General in the UK. It's the largest in the UK, largest fund manager, one of the largest in Europe, excluding companies that not responding on climate change. You know, we've seen Larry Fink from BlackRock contacting corporates. We've seen rising groups of investors supporting ESG. And there do seem to be strong evidence that investors are taking into account certainly the risks side of the equation, whether or not they're looking at the opportunities or not. So maybe investors are starting to look at things differently.
Yeah, I think, and this is for me, is a quite tricky question. For on one hand, we can see sustainability as you know, this is an important step. We want, if the corporation want to, if the investor want to have less risk in their portfolio, they want corporations who are less risky. And climate change is, of course, a big risk for society and all corporations. So on one hand, you can say all these quite small measures of demanding better sustainability from corporation is great, because then maybe we can hold corporation to account. We can then say, look, in your sustainability report or in your annual report, you said this and you're not doing that. Therefore, we're not going to invest in you, or we're not going to buy your products. So in that sense, we can see all these developments as positive. And in any case, I think we should. However, there's also this risk with, by doing all these minor things that we doesn't really have much an effect, we are delaying the radical responses that's actually needed. So this stops us from thinking more imaginatively in terms of what can we can do. How can we organize ourselves different? What can we really do to drastically reduce our society's emissions or the global emissions? So in that sense, one can also see this as a delay response in making sure that we actually don't have time to do anything.
Right. Again, I suppose the question is that necessarily the case? Can you not have them both at the same time? And to what extent does it, to what extent does this crowd out, as it were, other ideas, more imaginative ideas? There are all kinds of organizations, all kinds of radical thinking, different, you know, growing. I guess it's the question as well about the role of government and the degree to which various different governments also are willing to regulate, are willing to consider new radical ways of doing things, because fundamentally that's what we're going to need.
Yes, I agree. And I mean, I've done a little bit study around the fracking discussion in the UK. You can see how both Theresa May and the previous Cameron arguing all going all out for shale, and part of the argument is to address climate change. So they're saying shale gas is less unsustainable than coal. So in that sense, you know, you see Tindler Center and this research arguing, yes, but that also makes sure that we don't invest in renewables. So you can actually see argument suggesting that these kind of initiative are crowding out alternatives. We also see there's hardly no Western liberal democracy today arguing for any alternative than market solutions. So while you're saying there are radical alternatives, they're not really realistic, because they're not seen as doable. And part of that is not necessarily that they are not doable, it's that our frame in society is so strong towards continue what we're doing that any alternative seems ridiculous.
So the Paris Agreement doesn't give you confidence?
Absolutely not. If every country submitting to ratifying the Paris Agreement, say now, even if US stayed in it, if every country did what they promised in the Paris Agreement, you would still look for a 4-degree warming, because the Paris Agreement is based on scenarios where we come up with new technology, innovation, and so on.
Yes, well, these they're at the heart of all of the climate models, really, aren't they? I think there was actually a conference a couple of weeks ago in Sweden on new NETs, is that what they're called? Negative emissions technologies, which are, I guess, at the heart of a lot of this optimism, such as it is, about the possibility of dealing with climate change. So, again, we're looking at fairly short time frames. I just want to quickly talk about again this question of corporates and capital, because it's clear that increasingly, you know, large organizations, multilateral organizations, or like the World Bank, UNESCO, the UN, they're all looking to partner with corporations. They're all looking for capital. They're all looking to find new ways of doing things. So there is a capital shortage. The sums of money required to, you know, hit various the SDGs, things like that. They're eye-poppingly large sums of money. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, no, we see this. We even see NGOs engaging in this type of collaborations. Partly, this is, of course, understanding this is a societal or global problem. We need all actors to be involved. And on one hand, we can see that as a positive, you know, that almost everyone in society agreed that this is a global challenge that we need to address. We need all actors to dig in. We need all actors to come up with the best type of solutions. The problem, I guess, with inviting corporations is that they may have particular favored solution in mind. And that is, of course, solutions that allow them to make money and grow. And with this, I'm not saying that individual CEOs or individual sustainability managers are not concerned about climate change and trying to be devious. Absolutely not. Almost everyone we speak to is sincerely worried about this. However, within capitalism is a particular form of system that we had invented for corporations to make money. And that is when eventually what these corporations will need to do to survive. And this is fine. This is perfect. This is why we constructed the form of corporation, to make money, to take risks for us. And now I think that there's problematic in inviting them on equal basis with collaborations, with government, because they have their particular interest, which it may not necessarily be in line with what the planet demands from us.
Yes, there are many related important questions there. I suppose at the heart of this also is this, the talk about what you measure and what you get and what the outcomes are. And I would like to just maybe come back to that fundamental research you did, just the one you published in the Academy of Management. So with respect to your research on the different phases that the corporations went through in terms of trying to integrate sustainability within their business, did you find some corporations that were successful? And was this a surprising result? How have people responded to this? Because there does seem to be a growing body of research that suggests that actually it can be a win-win.
Yes, I think there's a growing focus on research that want to show a win-win. And a win-win here, again, is determined on your definitions. And I definitely think if corporations are slightly more energy efficient and that's a win, then we can definitely see win-wins. So we, I guess, take a more radical position in trying to follow corporations' commitments to these things. And so while we saw plenty of corporations doing good work, and doing really good work, we saw a lot of committed people in this organization trying to do the absolute best for the environment. I guess for us, it comes back to that moment when there is no business case. And that will always come in any business where you scale down your efficiency or invent new products. But that moment when that green promise is not necessarily driving more profit. Another problem is, of course, the short-termism of a lot of these corporations. The managers, they are operating on quite short-term business cases. You probably can see if the CEO is really committed, they can probably take better green initiative in the sense they allow for a longer return on the investment. So over a longer period of time, they're willing to see a win-win. And if you lift your eyes a bit towards the horizon and have a 3-year return on investment on green initiatives in corporation, you will see perhaps more of these win-wins. at the moment, a lot of them don't even justify that. So it is that win-win, it requires even short term. And this is a complex problem we're facing. And I don't think even a 3-year or 5-year term would suggest any wins for the environment. So when we talk about win-wins, I think we have diluted the idea of sustainability somewhat.
And things also change, don't they? There's dynamics of change that you hard to put down to one single thing, you know, like a one particular corporate activity, what you've got going on now in the motor industry, for example, is a complex of different factors interplaying, which just can create disruptive change rather than any one actor setting out necessarily to do that.
Yeah, but I think we're somewhat, and I'm definitely one of these, we are a bit blinded by this optimism, or maybe just the will to live in the sense of a good planet to live on. Because if you go back to just the motor industry you refer to, it hasn't really changed. How many percent of today's cars are electric? The cars has looked exactly the same. And the diesel scandal also illustrated, the Volkswagen diesel scandal also illustrated the nature of the beast. And I don't think the motor corporations are better or worse than any other. So this is the sort of dilemmas. They, of course, want to do things and sometimes they cheat a bit, but also they also mostly want to make money because that's what they were invented them for and that's what the investors require and this is what the employees want. So it's not, the car hasn't done much for the last 100 years almost. I mean, they look the same. They are mostly driven by combustion engines and they spew out fossil fuels. This hasn't been a revolution.
Well, it may well how that plays out, but the commitment of major companies to go to electric cars and they have their own questions as well, how sustainable they are in themselves in terms of the production and so forth. But there does seem to be it's certainly an example that people trot out and people talk about, and some people optimistically believe that there is a significant wave of change unfolding as we speak. How much has happened? Yes.
Yeah, but sorry. But we say even now, we all from tomorrow want to drive around Teslas.
Absolutely.
It doesn't solve the problem because you still need to sell more Teslas. So unless you then has no fossil fuel in the production and the energy goes into the Tesla is not fossil fuel, you haven't solved the problem.
Well, it's this question about growth, isn't it? It comes back to this question of economic growth, and it comes back to organizations that are optimized to grow, and organizations that are funded by organizations, by investors that are looking for growth. And in a sense, we all are, in the sense that our pensions and all the investments and so forth are tied into that. And it is quite interesting, I guess, to see what happens when people are confronted with the trade-off between growth and environmental actions, which is a whole other area, I guess. But yes, I mean, this question of fit for purpose. So I guess, in a sense, you're saying that the corporation is great at doing certain things. It's not fit for purpose in dealing with the key environmental sustainable issues that we're facing at the moment. What kind of, maybe we should come back to this again, what kind of organizations, I'd be interested in, a little bit in your thoughts there. I know in Sweden, certainly a more social democratic model and you know, some of the Scandinavian countries, a particularly good track record with respect to the environment. Do you see some exemplars there? Are there countries that are reinventing government or bringing in new government initiatives, finding ways that works?
Yeah, no. I wish what you said would give me some comfort. I don't really necessarily think that Sweden, with many other Scandinavian countries, has turned quite a lot towards the democratization of different aspects of society. And I think you perfectly illustrated the problem when you mentioned the pensions. We all are invested in the continuation of corporate capitalism. And that's why it's so hard to shift it, because we're all going to be losers. If it was just a few rich bankers or something that, at the moment has media against them, if or a few rich investors, if they were the only from Lewis, we would see a revolution against corporations now. We're not going to see that because they are ingrained in all our investments, in all our aspects of society. So when looking for alternatives, I guess it's really looking at alternatives that at the moment goes at, beside what we can see as a form of corporate capitalism. So we have communities perhaps engaging in with each other and energy communities owning up their own energy in Germany and Denmark, where the communities themselves organize and own their energy. Then there is no profit imperative, there's just an imperative to make sure that they can keep the lights on and have a decent life. So these kind of movements, and this will take time, but I think we need to develop them at the same time as we continue with the system. So when we realize that we have enough strength in our other alternative forms of organizing, communities or co-ops or city-owned or community-owned energy, food, and so on, we can make that shift without really stopping everything. Because that's, I guess, what everyone is scared of, is that idea that there's going to be a disruption, that's going to be violent, or which is highly problematic. So I think what we need to start doing is supporting alternative organizational form than corporate capitalism. And so when we need to shift that there is alternative ways of dealing with things, and alternative ways for us to live, that's not going to make a disruption. So that we, instead of identifying with a corporate brand, we identify with other community relations than our consumption. Because at the moment today, most of us, me included, identify a lot with their corporate brands. This is not just an exchange. This is really who we are as human beings. We are the phones and the clothes we wear. We identify with the cars we drive. I think we also need to shift that human psyche and start identifying with other social relations that is not corporate capitalist driven.
Yes, this question of the values, and we talked about the influence of organizations to some degree, and the whole neoliberal agenda, which has been certainly we've had a couple of decades of, and some people believe that we are seeing some changes there, and some questions in the IMF starting to issue different kinds of publications, use different kind of language, talking about neoliberalism and so forth.
Yes, I think you're right in that we see some more skepticism towards this. Yeah. I mean, both the major parties in most liberal democracies moved towards a centre where the centre was neoliberalism. So that goes, for example, Labour in the UK, but also in this classical social democratic countries, they moved far towards marketization and in sorting out their policies. And we also see almost an impossibility for redistribution today. So part of why we're also looking for corporations is because we cannot any longer look for government for funding.
Yes, yes.
So with the incorporation of the government, I mean, it's impossible for any government to raise the tax with 5 to 10%. Even in well-functioning society, it's just not realistic. They've been voted out immediately to suggest that, all right, even middle-income earners can easily deal with another 5% and try to redistribute these through normal tax system. It's impossible to imagine that because we are so committed to having two holidays using, you know, some of the air carriers. We are committed to having two cars per family. So I'm not talking about, of course, those in society that are the most vulnerable. I'm talking to, you know, the big midsection of society that easily can handle this if they're just willing to change lifestyle. But we're not.
Yes, we're all involved in it together, and I know that some of the academics, Kevin Anderson for one, climate change academic, talking about an activist talking about the flying to conferences and the if you look at the consumption pattern of the, you know, top 10-20% and compare that with, you know, average levels, you could see some pretty dramatic impact that the wealthiest portions of society actually have to pay. How important do you think carbon pricing is? And is that a reflection of the commitment of governments to really dealing with some of the, well, so-called externalities, but the climate change and environmental problems we face?
Yeah, I think carbon pricing is, for me, a market mechanism that is designed around the market. And for me, that still supports the current trajectory. It does not necessarily completely alter the trajectory, unless you have a really, really, really tough cap. But at the moment, we're not looking at any tough caps in these carbon pricing or carbon taxations. We're rather looking at market schemes where there is still potentiality for growth, which for me is not really within what we need to do to keep this planet at a healthy level. So for me, carbon pricing is not discussed in a way that really really is in, according to what is required. If there was a cap that suggests that 80% of the fossil fuel would stay in ground, sure, I could support that. But then comes another problem. That means very few rich countries, or rich corporations, rich individuals can be able to pay for this. But those most vulnerable in any society, or the most vulnerable societies, is not. So for me, the question you asked me around how will these organizations look like? What kind of organizations do we need to foster and as human beings, both in terms of individual freedom, but also in terms of solidarity? And I don't think any serious scholars in this is going to back to some form of state planning communism, but we still need to look at alternative forms of organization that does not mean corporate capitalism, avoiding that binary. Because as soon as you criticize corporate capitalism, you get the communist hit back at you. But there's a range of different ways we can organize us and have done in throughout history. I mean, the time on Earth for corporate capitalism is very short. We have other forms of organizing. And I'm not saying they were good, but maybe they can be developed. How can we develop cooperatives to deal with some of these problems? How can we develop communities to deal with some of these problems? B Corps in that sense. Maybe not. What are the good things about B Corps? How would the next version of that look like?
Yes. It's quite a challenging agenda to think through these questions and to as you say, need an active imagination. An act of radical imagination to think of some solutions and think of new ways forward, and I suppose to be willing to try them and be willing to fail as well, but to willing to create an ecology of different kinds of organizations. The question I was going to ask you before. Now, there are questions about the degree to which you've raised questions about the degree to which sustainability initiatives can be profitable for corporations. I guess not necessarily on an isolated basis, but on an ongoing basis, that a sustainability strategy would generate continually growing profits over time. I guess there are the other side of the question is as well is the other side of the coin is that if you look at nature, you could say it's one of the last uncommodified spaces. And what the risk is here, the massive sums of money going into that are required for the SDGs, for example, the massive sums of money that are required for the new energy solutions, that essentially that if it's corporations that are going to be the agents of development of these new solutions, that we're just going to see an increasingly intense commodification of the last outpost, maybe before space.
I completely agree with that analysis, and I think we are seeing that. I mean, in the UK, you have that Nature Market Task Force, and we see that in all types of countries and associations are trying to come up with a number for the environment. So how many billions are the bees in the UK worth in terms of their pollination of both crops for eating, but also for flowers and so on? So if we put a price on bees, maybe we can save them, because if they have a value, we can save them.
But that's an interesting question. That's an interesting question, because I spoke to Cameron Hepburn at Oxford University about this, and he said that this is just quite similar to what you do in the health system. You know, you have to make these assessments. You put a value on a human life. It's not that you're actually valuing the human life, but you use it for assessments of the kinds of medical interventions that you can actually provide. So it's really just a guidance mechanism. It's not actually saying that you're going to be, you know, turning the human body into some kind of market.
Well, yes and no. That is, if you think that language is completely neutral, it is not a problem. But if you think language is performative, in the sense of if we say something, that will also form our thinking and our discussions. So if you start putting a price on things, that could then start informing the decisions. And we can also see then how we can evaluate decisions based on these pricing. So I think it's a bit more problematic in that. And that is some of these languages we've seen in creeping into other discourses among health, but also education, where things start evaluating money. And then eventually those monetary terms, they're so good because they're comparative. You can measure them. It's quite easy to take decisions on them compared to the complexity of values. So if you think about a plurality of value systems, the monetary value system is just one, but we can also see an alternative. Just an example would be the legal system. Here, value is not deemed in monetary terms, it's deemed in the legal jurisdiction. So whether something is right, it's not based on money, it's based on the justice of the law system in place. So we can then see countries now starting to give nature rights. You know, we have corporations defending in courts of law by when they are not even a natural product, they're an invention of us. They're defended by lawyers. And perhaps soon we will see nature being defended by lawyers. So that's an alternative value regime we can look at. How can we make sure that bees are given rights to ensure that they are, they can do their job for the planet?
That's very interesting. I won't talk about the drones that I read about, which are being used now to as a substitute for bees.
Yes, you can see how then if it's cheaper to come up with a drone than bee, why would you want bees?
Well, it's a very scary prospect.
I think our kind of language has this performative effect that the way we talk about things form our thinking, form our arguments. And then even if it started innocent, these numbers never are innocent when they're used to rationalize decisions.
Right. And to what extent have you had a response from the academic environment? Have people said, well, this just doesn't make sense in light of what we all believe at the moment? This goes against it or actually, you know, otherwise?
Yeah, I think there's been both. I mean, the peer review process in the journal, Academy of Management Journal, is really solid. And the reviewers of our paper, they did not necessarily want to hear the message, I think, because it's an uncomfortable message, especially if you work in a business school. So I think they pushed us well in trying for us to explain our research findings and our arguments. And I think after that now been explained, I think in some detail, I think the business community is not super surprised, even though, you know, we don't want to hear it, but we sort of know it's true. And then there are different types of journals. So when Nature, the journal, want to summarize this in the journal, they were quite willing to take on the whole message. When Harvard Business Review want to summarize it, maybe there was more discussion of whether, is this really what we want to say? Or that didn't censor us in any absolute no way, but there was this sense of maybe we can frame it a bit more welcoming towards the corporation.
So are you depressed by the prospects that, you know, getting to the heart of this question, you know, you don't doubt the scale, the challenges that we face, and yet the trajectory, the direction of travel and the trajectory and the pace of travel, that's another matter.
Yes, no, I'm very bleak in terms of what's going to happen. I cannot see us staying under 4 degrees warming, and we know what we don't know, but we can imagine what kind of Earth this is delivering. So, but I'm not a cynical, I'm not depressed. I'm working with a term called hope without optimism, in the sense of how we as societies can learn to live within these means. Together in peaceful societies where we can live in a more troubled world, but also perhaps looking at other ways to satisfy our need for social relations and so on.
What's on your agenda next?
So I'm involved in quite a few really interesting projects, at least for me. So two big projects. One is a grant I just got from the Australian government in trying to understand the energy transition. So how both follow what arguably is the necessary destruction of the coal industry and how they unfold in during their phasing out. So we can see, especially in the coal industry in Australia, it used to be a quite homogeneous group. They were always on the same side. But now we can see they start fighting for survival and attack each other. So for BHP has moved out of some of the big industry associations. You can see the infighting in coal starting, realizing, you know, we can't all be friends anymore. It's, you know, the survival of the fittest in selling those fossil fuel left in the ground. So on one hand, we want to follow the coal industry now the next few years and see how they politically try to shape the environment to make sure that they can continue selling coal. On the other hand, we're also going to look at the renewable industry in Australia to see how they are trying to gain an uptake at community level. So how can solar, which would be fantastic for Australia, I mean, it could easily survive on solar alone, and wind, how these things can be taken up in communities, but also how the prospects politically in making these movements stronger. So this is one project following the energy transition over time. The other project we do is looking at climate change adaptation. So when we talk about climate change, we often talk about the future. But climate change is now. It's already changing the world. So we're looking at places where climate change is at the moment negotiated and discussed. So one of them is the Great Barrier Reef. Half the reef was bleached just the other year. And we're looking at, if we continue as we do, we could be out without the largest organism on the planet be dead within the next couple of decades. So already now we can see how the tourist industry on the reef is trying to, you know, negotiate their future. So a few tourist industry go, oh, last chance tourism, see the reef before it's dead. Other tourist industries start suing climate change scientists because they're providing messages that they think stop the tourists from coming. And then so we can see how these areas now, where in even the Western world, where climate change is negotiated, adaptation is going on. And this, of course, is happening in much more catastrophically in more vulnerable societies at the moment. But our focus is on corporations and how they involve in society.
Well, you've got a full agenda there, and I wish you the very best.
Exciting.
Very exciting, very interesting area. I wish you the very best of success with that, and thank you so much for taking your time today to get involved in this spirited debate and discussion and share your research and ideas. It's been fascinating to talk to you.
Thank you so much, Fergal. I really appreciate you taking the time and inviting me on.
Thank you for listening to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. I hope you found it interesting. Please sign up at the sustainabilityagenda.com website or on iTunes to make sure you don't miss any future episodes.